Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. This week we are all about sharks. And to be honest, when shouldn't we be? Sharks are epic. Even better, we are talking to an expert. Marine conservation biologist David Schiffman from Washington DC joined me for a chat about our shared love for these marine predators. From where to find them, how they eat, how old they can get, all the way to how to save them, David goes into some expert detail on the real struggles sharks face and what options we should be open to in order to continue to save these wonderful animals. I'm not going to keep blabbing on because this topic is one of my favourites, so enjoy the show and even more importantly, love sharks. Hello, David. Welcome to Into the Wild. Thank you so much for joining me on today's episode. How are you over stateside?
Doing fine here, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
No worries. It's a pleasure. Like I just said to you, I've been so excited for this episode. I'm a huge fan of the marine world, yet don't know much about it. So it's been an exciting couple of days for me. Looking forward to this one. Just so people are aware, the listeners around the world, can you explain who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name is Dr. David Schiffman. I'm a marine conservation biologist who focuses on the ecology and conservation of shark species. And I'm also a science communicator. You can find me on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Why Sharks Matter, where I'm always happy to answer any questions that anyone has about sharks.
Amazing. I think that's how I found you, because I'm a huge shark fan. They're my favorite animal, and which we'll go on to them in a minute. But this is the main reason, why I've been buzzing about this interview. The question I always ask people at the very top of the episode, for you, when did your first and love for wildlife begin?
Well, I've loved the ocean in general, and sharks specifically, as long as my family can remember. There are pictures of me when I was 2 and 3 years old with shark toys and shark t-shirts and things like that. And I grew up pretty far from the ocean in Pittsburgh, about 1,000 kilometers inland. And there aren't sharks there. But I read every book I could get my hands on, and I watched every documentary I could find. And we did have sharks at the Pittsburgh Zoo, which had an associated aquarium, which I used to love. But I've always known that this is what I want to do. And I always tell people I've been doing since all these COVID lockdowns have started, I've been Zooming into classroom groups around the world. And I'm always careful to say, it's okay if you don't know what you want to be when you grow up.
Yeah.
You can always figure that out later. But I always have known. And my parents were always very supportive, though I suspect they thought I would grow out of it someday, and I never did. But there's not one discrete moment. It's just sort of always been the case that I've always been fascinated by, even obsessed by, the ocean in general and sharks specifically.
Do you think
now I'm living my childhood dream?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's incredible. And do you think it's kind of the interest of the unknown? Because the ocean's such a mysterious place still to many of us. Do you think it's that kind of, almost, if I compare it to, like, you know, astronauts for space, it's that interest of, like, what is out there. Do you think that's a similar interest?
That's a big part of it, for sure. There's a lot that we have left to learn about the ocean. But what we do know, it makes this seem like a worthy avenue for my professional interests. We know that the ocean is vitally important for many species that humans care about, and for humans ourselves, for food, for recreation, for employment, for climate regulation. And we know that the ocean's in trouble.
Yeah.
So that's why I sort of the biggest career shift I've sort of had is from being a marine biologist to a marine conservation biologist, which is a little bit of tomato-tomato type stuff.
Yeah.
But it's an explicit focus on using science to solve real-world practical environmental problems rather than sort of knowledge for the sake of knowledge. There's nothing wrong with that kind of pure science. It's just not the sort of stuff I do. I start my research with, here is a specific problem that a conservation organization or management agency or other conservation biologist has identified as requiring scientific focus. So start there.
Yeah, and like you said, they kind of go hand in hand anyway. Like, you get the knowledge and we can use that post, but it's incredibly more helpful when you start with, right, why are we doing this before we do it, kind of thing, and why are we find it out. Let's talk about sharks. You're a huge fan of them. I'm a huge fan of them. My first question is, I'm terrified of sharks. And I think that's why I love them. Do you share that?
I don't think I'm terrified of sharks, and you don't need to be terrified of sharks, but there is, you should treat them with a healthy respect. There is a growing movement. 20 years ago, there was this big idea that the reason sharks are in trouble is because humans are terrified of them, and we need to combat that. And that's not really the case anymore, if it ever was to a large degree. Now there's a problem of the pendulum swinging too far in the other direction, and people saying, actually, sharks aren't dangerous at all. They're big, cute, adorable puppy dogs, and they just need hugs and kisses. There are literally people who hug and kiss wild sharks.
Oh, God.
And don't do that. I mean, I can't believe how often I have to say that to adult humans. That you can, sharks are not bloodthirsty monsters that will kill your whole family if you dip your toe in the bathtub.
Yeah.
But they're also not puppy dogs. They're large, wild predators that can and do hurt people sometimes. And you should not be terrified of them, and you should not want to exterminate them, but don't give them a hug.
It's just not what we should be saying. Why do we do it? Why do we always go from one extreme to the other? It's such a human thing. We always like to go, well, that record's done. Let's flip it and put the other side on. It's like, it's not.
Exactly, yes.
You know, there's other records, you know. There's other ways to look at it. So let's get to the basics of sharks. Where can we find sharks on our planet?
So there's a joke amongst U.S. Navy SEALs that there's a test for determining if there are sharks in the water. And that test is you dip your finger in the water and taste it, and if the water's salty, there are sharks there.
Wow, okay.
But that's even not quite true, because they're also found some places where the water is not salty. So if they're found in the ocean and rivers worldwide.
Wow.
As far north as the Arctic, as far south as the extreme southern tips of South America and South Africa and Australia, skates are found, which are a relative of sharks, are found in Antarctica. So the whole, if you look at a map, the blue part.
I love that. Okay, the blue part is where you can find them. And you said there the Arctic, which is something I'm really interested in, because I think one of my favorite shark species is from the Arctic, and that's the Greenland, the Greenland shark.
Greenland sharks, they're awesome.
Yeah, they're amazing, aren't they? I learned about these sharks last year, and I just could not believe the information I was hearing. Can you share some light about the Greenland shark for us?
So Greenland sharks are a large, they can be, I think, 4, 5, 6 meters long, so big.
Mm.
They can live in the deep, and they live under the Arctic ice, though they have been caught as far south as Florida.
Oh, wow.
Possibly farther south. That's just the case I know of that was recent in Florida that research crews caught one. They are probably the longest living vertebrate animals in the world. They might live to be over 400 years old.
That's incredible.
It takes them, they don't become reproductively mature adults until they're in their mid-160s, which means that's a long time to be going through puberty, right?
Yeah.
And they also, what is something that lives in the Arctic eat? Well, they eat small fish, they eat seals, but some things that have been found in their stomachs include polar bears and reindeer.
What?
Isn't that bananas? So polar bears are the largest land predator in the whole world.
Yeah.
And Greenland sharks eat them.
Well, how?
We don't know if it's scavenging. It's probably scavenging, but they've just been found in the stomach. But, you know, polar bears swim from ice floe to ice floe, and it's not possible to defend yourself against a 6-meter-long thing coming up from below you while you're doing that. So maybe sometimes they're hunted. That's never been seen. But we do know that polar bear bones have been found in Greenland shark stomachs. And reindeer, too.
Well, how the hell did reindeer end up there?
They swim sometimes.
You don't? Wow.
Yeah, so Greenland sharks are awesome. They're also the slowest swimming large fish ever measured. They can accelerate, but their normal cruising speed is so slow that when I play a video of it in my public talks, people ask me if the screen's not working. when I act out in my public talks, people think I'm exaggerating by walking that slow. And most of the adults are blind because they have a parasite that lives in their eye. If you look at pictures of Greenland sharks, they have this sort of milky white eye with a little strand coming off it. That's parasite. Greenland sharks are super cool.
How are these animals alive? That's incredible that they, I mean, from their age, like you said, 400 years old, 160 year average maturity rate, and then I can't get over that polar bear and reindeer to be found with that. That's a real, you know, from one end of the spectrum to another for food, really.
Yep.
Wow, that's amazing. Do you have a favourite shark?
My favourite shark is the sandbar shark, which I think you call the brown shark over on your side of the Atlantic.
Yes,
And they are, if your listeners follow hashtag best shark, all one word, on Twitter and Instagram, you'll see years of me talking about these animals and how much I love them. And you'll also see years of other shark researchers teasing me for choosing what they perceive to be a boring animal as best shark. But I'll tell you why I love them.
Yes, please do.
They are sort of a stereotypical sharky shark. They don't have crazy tails like thresher sharks. They don't have crazy heads like hammerheads. They don't have crazy patterns like tiger sharks. Mm. They're just, picture a shark and you're picturing something that looks an awful lot like a sandbar or brown shark.
Yeah.
And despite not having those advantages, they punch above their weight in terms of both public outreach and science. There is a large population of juvenile sandbar sharks right at the base of the Chesapeake, a large estuary in the U.S., which is near where I live, and that happens to be right near where the Virginia Institute of Marine Science is located, and that's the longest-running shark survey in the world.
Wow.
Which means, because there is this population of sandbar sharks coincidentally right by where this lab was built, they're one of the best-studied shark species in the world. So they contributed significantly to our understanding of the ocean. Also, if anyone's ever been to a shark tank at an aquarium just about anywhere, there's probably a sandbar shark or brown shark in there. They do very well in captivity. And what that means is, for millions of children, this is the first shark they've ever seen in their whole life.
Yeah, what a great point.
So I love my sandbar sharks. They're actually the logo of my science and environment consultancy.
Amazing. That is a high status, that is.
Yeah. Love my sandbars.
So that's great. So they're just, for you, they're that animal that we can, and when I say get the most from, I don't mean that in a human selfish way, but literally they give in so much to us.
They've given a lot to us, and without being anything fancy. They're just a basic model, a classic model shark, as I would say. Classics never go out of style.
They're like the retrievers of the shark world. The golden retrievers.
And they were also the animal I studied for my master's research, which means they weren't the first shark I ever saw, but they're the first shark I ever saw a lot of.
Wow, that's cool. That's great. Now, another thing rightfully, people and scientists, and it's well known when we're talking about sharks, we refer to them as an apex predator, or like one of the top predators. Why is that? What is it about the shark that makes them so apex?
So there are over 550 species of sharks, and not all of them are apex, but many are. You have something like the Greenland shark, which is so apex, so top of the food chain, that they eat freaking polar bears sometimes. But there are also some smaller species that are sort of mid-level predators, what we call mesopredators in ecology speak. They're sort of the same level of the food chain as something like a grouper.
Yeah.
So they have an enormous variety of what are called trophic roles, of jobs that they have within the food chain. But many of the ocean's top predators are sharks. You have something like the tiger shark, which is one of very few species in the ocean that can eat sea turtles. Mm. You have something like the great white shark, one of the very few species in the ocean that can eat dolphins, that can eat big seals.
Yeah.
But orcas can still take out either of those, and do. So they're definitely, in many of the larger species of sharks, are pretty close to the top of the food chain. But the biggest one, the whale shark, which is more tropical, and the basking shark, which you have in UK waters, they are filter feeders like the great whales.
Yeah.
So not all species are apex predators, but many are, and people are fascinated by carnivores. People are, when people go on a photo safari on vacation, they want to see the lions, they want to see the leopards, they want to see the cheetahs. Even though there's some really fascinating species of gazelle and antelope that are more common there, that you're more likely to see, that also play important ecological roles. People are just inherently fascinated by the apex predators.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I love many sharks. Sandbars are often in their environment are top of the food chain, but not always. They are sometimes eaten by bull sharks, and things like that.
Yeah.
I think it's quite common knowledge as well about sharks being endangered. And I think, if I'm right, pretty much all species on some level are considered vulnerable in the oceans at the moment. But how endangered are sharks currently?
Yeah, so some species are absolutely in big conservation trouble, but definitely not all. And that's an important thing for me to clarify here. Mm. According to the IUCN Red List, which is an international group of scientific experts that uses the best available data to do this sort of standard assessment of how threatened the species is, about 24% of all known species of sharks and their relatives are considered threatened with extinction, which is a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot.
Nearly one out of every four. But that means that three out of every four aren't.
Yeah.
And this is a lot of the work that I do, is learning from what's working with the management of those species that are doing better to hopefully apply it to the species that are not doing as well. So it is important to note that, yes, absolutely, many species of sharks are in trouble, and that's a big problem. But there's a common misconception that that means that all of them are, and that's just not the case. And it's an important thing to know, because it affects public support for conservation policies, which is a lot of the stuff that I do.
Mm.
So there's this movement called Ocean Optimism, and run by the Smithsonian. And basically the premise of this is, it's important that everyone is aware of all the bad stuff that's happening in conservation, but we also have to highlight the success stories, because both, if you only talk about bad news, people will ignore you.
Mm.
And also, if people don't know that there's a way to fix it, they'll give up.
Yeah.
So knowing that, it's important to know that many species of sharks are absolutely in trouble, and that's bad, and we need to do something. But it's also important to know that in many cases, we know what to do because we've done it and it worked.
And there's always a number that floats around, which is, I've heard a lot in my wildlife career, which is, you know, between 100 and 120 million. That's a number that's always floated around with how many sharks that are killed each year by people. How accurate is that number to this day?
So the number of approximately 100 million sharks a year, let me put that in context.
Mm.
That is the best available global estimate we have, but it is essentially, it's a back of the envelope calculation.
Okay.
That's actually the median of a long series of models. So what that means is, that's probably pretty close to correct with the available data we have, but there's a huge range in those models, and it may be worse than that, it may be not that bad. A lot of the issue comes from, typically in fisheries management type things, we don't measure the number of individuals killed, we measure total number of tons caught.
Ah, gotcha.
So the reason why there's this variation in models is, 1,000 tons of 5-kilogram sharks is very different from 1,000 tons of 50-kilogram sharks in terms of the number actually represented. So we needed a number to use in policy documents. That's the best one we have. It's important to note that I've often seen that misrepresented as the number of sharks killed exclusively for shark fin soup. Mm-hmm. That's not true. It's not that. It's all sharks killed for any reason, including that, but also including sharks killed accidentally, sharks killed for their meat, things like that. So,
okay. So, yeah, that makes
sense.
There's
a lot of caveats with that one. But, yes, that's absolutely a published peer-reviewed figure, and it's the best number we have. But a lot of scientists use it sort of with an enormous grain of salt.
Yes, it's one of those things, like you said, it's got such a big range. You go, it's the closest we've got, but that's, you know, that's what we're going to use. And
exactly.
So what, you know, we don't like to focus too much, like you said, a bit of the optimism. So what's being done to save sharks currently?
There are a lot of different things that are being done, and it sort of depends on the problem. And one thing that's an issue is that people have only generally heard of one of these types of solutions. The idea of banning all fishing for sharks, or banning all trade in any shark products, gets a ton of media attention. I actually just had a paper accepted last week, or published last week, that was about how shark conservation is portrayed in the global English-speaking media.
Mm.
And this idea that there's no such thing as a well-managed fishery for sharks, so we have to ban all fishing, gets a ton of attention, and it's not true.
Yeah.
There absolutely are sustainable, well-managed fisheries for sharks, and those are widely, there's a ton of scientific evidence showing that that works. For some species, there's overwhelming support from scientists, And you wouldn't know that from reading the newspaper or from reading social media of environmental groups.
Yeah.
So that works. And in fact, off the East Coast, the Southeast Coast of the U.S., where I live, over the last 20 years when we've had this sustainable management for shark fisheries, shark populations have increased.
Wow.
So what with fishing happening, populations can still recover if it's part of a well-managed sustainable fishery.
Yeah.
There are some species that absolutely cannot support a fishery. Think of something like a Greenland shark. You're not going to be able to recover your populations quickly if it takes you 160 years to be able to reproduce.
Yes, that makes sense.
That's just like fisheries management 101 is if it takes something that long, it's in bad shape and you should leave it alone.
Yeah.
But there are other species where some sort of catch bans are needed, or sometimes what's called a retention ban, which means we can't stop you from catching it, but if you catch it, let it go immediately. And sometimes there's bans on international trade. There's an international treaty called CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Many shark species are listed on this, though they're listed on a part of it that doesn't ban trade. It just requires thorough documentation. So there's a lot of different things that people can do. And I actually have a review paper about this published in the journal Animal Conservation that is explicitly written for people who are not PhDs in policy. So the goal of this is you want to know what's going on with shark conservation, read this, even if you're just so-called regular person who wants to know.
That's amazing.
So that what most people's reaction to reading that article is, who I've spoken to, which is several dozen non-expert shark conservation enthusiasts, is, wow, I had no idea how many of these tools were out there. You only ever hear about, oh, goodness, we have to ban everything.
Yes.
And those bans aren't always the right answer, and they're not always supported by scientific experts and evidence. So that's a problem.
Let's talk about the ocean a little bit, because we know it's a very delicate place. What changes have we seen over the last few years in regards to the ocean and its health?
Well, there's a lot of what's interesting to note here is that some of the biggest threats to the ocean in general are not the same thing that are the biggest threats to sharks.
Mm.
So climate change is a big threat to the ocean. It's very bad for many ocean species. It's disastrous for corals and any of the thousands of species that rely on coral reefs. Climate change is generally not that bad for sharks. They can just move. If their current habitat is suddenly slightly too warm, they can go north a little in our hemisphere, or south in the southern hemisphere, and then a place that used to be a little too cold is now just right.
Yeah.
Plastic pollution was something that you had asked me about in our initial correspondence.
Yeah.
Big problem for lots of species, not that big a problem for sharks.
Okay.
Even filter feeding sharks, like the whale sharks and their relatives, manta rays, which are also filter feeding, there's very dramatic videos of them swimming through clouds of plastic. They're almost certainly ingesting plastic, and that's probably not great. But it is not a population-level threat.
Okay, that's interesting.
The thing that I focus on, as a conservation biologist, my goal is stopping species from going extinct.
Mm.
And that means if a few individuals are not having a great life, that's bad, but it's not my top priority.
Yes, yeah.
My top priority is stopping the whole species from going extinct.
Yeah.
Unsustainable overfishing is hands down the greatest threat to biodiversity in the ocean. And that is also true for sharks. There are sustainable fisheries, but unsustainable fisheries are common and are the biggest threat. So the single greatest thing that people can do is, if you're going to eat seafood, and I'm not a person who will tell you, if you care about the ocean, don't ever eat seafood at all. If you're going to eat seafood, eat certified sustainable seafood. And over on your side of the pond, that's the Marine Conservation Society of the UK has the best fish guide. Marine Stewardship Council has those blue check marks. You can trust that.
Yes, absolutely.
There's real science behind that. It doesn't mean there's never any arguments or controversy, but it's not nothing.
Yes, yeah. So that's the best way people can kind of look into, like you said, it's people can make their decisions whether they're going to eat fish or not. That's completely up to them. And if they decide they're going to, the best thing to do is to look up the Marine Conservation Society and actually look at their booklet guide.
Yes, and over on my part of the world in the U.S., we have the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, which is a similar type of thing. And folks can download an app on their phone. They can print off a little piece of paper that folds up and fits in your wallet. You can trust that, too. Again, that doesn't mean there's never any controversy with any of the listings, but they're based on solid, replicable science and real data.
And it's important to remember, I guess, that these things change. It's not just a one-time thing, a one-time booklet that remains forever. It's important to remember to check in on that kind of information to see what changes as the world goes on. My last question to you, and this is something, again, I ask all my guests, if you could pass on just one bit of advice to everyone regarding the natural world, what would you pass on to them?
The most important thing that I would love for people to know, especially from an ocean conservation side, is that right now there are a lot of threats and there's a lot of people proposing solutions that need your help. And some of those people are experts and are proposing data-driven, evidence-backed solutions that will actually make a difference if you help them. And some of them are con artists. Some of them are what we call in the U.S. snake oil salesmen. I don't know if that idiom translates. They're people that are making up nonsense to get your money so you can feel good that you helped, when there's absolutely no evidence of any kind that what they're saying makes any good, and sometimes there's evidence that it's bad.
Yeah.
So listen to experts. Ocean conservation science is a real thing. We don't need anyone to guess. We don't need anyone to reinvent the wheel poorly. Trying to help and wanting to help is great, but that's not the same thing as actually helping.
Yes.
And it's important that people know that.
Amazing. David, thank you so much for your time on the show today. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk about my passion to you with your passion. So thank you so much for joining me, and I wish you all the best in the rest of the year to come.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and shows that David is working on, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at Why Sharks Matter. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify and Podbean. You can also get in touch on social media at Into the Wild Pod. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you'd like to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe and live the good life.